Officer Navarro's sister, Julia, is increasingly hearing a spooky call that has her attempting to follow it out onto the ice and into the sea. In this episode, she can no longer resist the urge and leaves the treatment facility to drown herself in the Arctic Ocean. This sends Navarro spiraling into violence and ultimately fatalism, worrying that it's only a matter of time before she, too, is forced to hear the same call. Meanwhile, Chief Danvers is facing down her own demons, with the missing men and women under eerie circumstances and the pressures of the case driving her to drink and engage in self-destructive behavior. Both women are united once again with a hot tip by the local fisherman that a strange man wearing a pink parka is seen at the abandoned gold dredges on the outskirts of Venice. Investigating the dredges, Danvers finds Otis Heiss, a man who Peter had previously identified as suffering similar injuries over 20 years ago as the men from the Salal station, including burnt corneas, ruptured eardrums, and self-inflicted bite wounds. His mind seems to be gone, as all he can do is rave about the night country. Navarro, however, finds disturbing visions of her dead sister, and Danvers finds her by the end of the episode in a catatonic state with blood trickling from her ears.
From the dusty mesa, her looming shadow.
Welcome to The World We Deserve, the officially unofficial podcast for True Detective on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking Season 4, Episode 4, Night Country, Part 4. Aaron, you had a couple days to sit with the episode. Hopefully your brain is a little less fogged. I know I'm feeling a little bit better. What'd you think of this episode?
It is a good episode, and much like some of the middle episodes of season one of True Detective, there's not a lot of movement on the case. We got far more information about the detectives investigating than we did truly new information. But also, all that stuff kind of ties back together too. Like, I think you're supposed to understand that, you know, some of the creepy stuff going on personally is probably going to connect back to the case. I continue to be impressed with, like, the characters and the acting. I was particularly impressed that they made me feel sorry for Hank. I was, like, starting off very much Nelson from The Simpsons. Ha ha! Out of all of his bullshit. But by the time he's staring catatonic at his camouflaged bed sheets covered in rose petals, I'm like, oh, man, you really invested. You invest a lot. And in fact, like, on subsequent watches, I got that I don't think he's seen this woman. I don't think he's seen. Like, he's getting catfish sight unseen. No photos.
No photos.
Why else would he, like, have this kind of, like, expectant smile when the stewardess is looking like she's going to get off? Like, he, like he's like that might be her. I
he
don't
needs
think
glasses.
He knows.
And she's also maybe blonde. I don't know. Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point.
So I think it's a pretty good episode when they can make you feel sympathetic to just a shit person like Hank. What'd you think?
Boy, that's an extra level of desperation, huh? I mean, it speaks to kind of one of the big themes of this season is loneliness. And that really came through this episode. Just everybody being lonely, you know, that's what Navarro says. She asks Kavik, you know, why are you alone? Talking about life. He claims that he's not, because I think he thinks he's got her. I like this episode. One of the things I've appreciated as of this episode is the way they've been telling this story is remarkably subtle in a lot of areas. Like, I think of the stuff we think we know, and the more we see, the more the stuff we think we know turns out to be true, which means they've dropped really successful little hints along the way. Like, I think this episode goes a long way to say that Liz has a drinking problem, or had a drinking problem. Tough to say. There are a couple little details we could talk about maybe when we get to her. There are a lot of things that we suspected, like Hank was getting catfished. You just kind of feel that. It's nothing that they explicitly spell out, but we kind of picked it up as we went, and it turned out to be true. That fight with the hillbillies last episode, that was caused by a shooting. It, like, all the little crumbs they're putting down, we're absolutely sniffing out. And I feel like that's a really elegant way to tell this story.
Yeah, I agree. So
they're doing a really good job there.
Like the show has not come out and said, oh, Liz lost Pete, or not Pete, Jake and Connors. Connors?
Connolly?
What? Holden. Oh, yeah. I was close.
Connolly.
I was close.
Yeah, she's like not lost Connolly. Letters,
right? that she lost this to a drunk driving accident, but it's never come out and said. And then mm-hmm. you're supposed to, but if you haven't gotten that from the storytelling, then, you know, alarm bells might not be flashing about her drinking and driving like an asshole.
Right.
You know, and but like also Connolly's reaction to like, did you drive? Like, you know, you're supposed to understand that this is pretty transgressive behavior. Stacey fucking Chalmers probably only exists to show that she has a mm-hmm. special antipathy towards people with these. So it's like it's giving insights into her emotional state.
Yeah.
And it's like the epitome of show don't tell storytelling.
I think so. Yeah. And as she spirals further down, she sort of leans into those behaviors. They're unhealthy. And yeah, I think it's been told really well. That theme of loneliness really comes across in this episode, you know, overtly, but also there's a character who says the line, but there's also just a lot of loneliness happening on screen. I mean, Hank, desperate. I mean, like I said, how desperate do you have to be to marry someone sight unseen from another country? You've never met them. You've just chatted on the phone. He's desperately lonely. So is Liz. And like that scene with the turkey that she dumps in the trash can, that's desperate loneliness is what that is.
Yeah. And even Pete, who is married and has a beautiful young family, like it's hard to show a lonelier scene than him and his wife laying in the bed with their backs to each other and about 17 feet between them. I don't know how you do that in a queen size bed.
The only way you can do it more intensely is the way Better Call Saul did it, which is you actually do a split screen and then they end up in the same bed with a split screen.
Dividing the bed. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. I was going to make that joke for the Hank thing you mentioned that it's hard to achieve the level of sweaty desperation in the freezing cold night country, but yet Hank manages to do it. He's got that. And you're right. Liz dumping the chicken, or I'm sorry, the turkey had a similar kind of feel. So there's a lot of our detectives feel like their backs are against the wall for very different reasons. You know, mm-hmm. Navarro feels like she is succumbing to this family curse. Liz feels like her life is spiraling out of control. There's a referendum on her being a police person. Kind of the things she's struggling with are starting to really sandbag her. And all in the backdrop of this this crazy mystery they're trying to solve.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I really enjoyed this episode.
I will say before we go much further, because it's been kind of like we've gotten conflicting reports, it's confirmed. It's confirmed now that they are not skipping a week for the Super Bowl. However, much like they did for The Last of Us last season, they are going to release on Max online the new episode on Friday night. It's virtual Sunday night at HBO. They're releasing that on Max, and then HBO will be airing it Sunday at its regular time. I imagine most true fans of True Detective are going to be watching Friday night. Unfortunately, because of some travel issues with Jim and some previous commitments that I've made, this completely fucks up our instant take schedule. We are not going to be able to do an instant take on Friday night. And maybe we could do it on Sunday, but at that point, I feel like it's almost pointless. You know, most people who have watched it are going to go ahead and watch it. So instead, we'll just have our full podcast out on Tuesday. I apologize for that, because I do like to do this stuff with the club members, and I'm really looking forward to talking it over with y'all. It's just I had a pre-existing commitment before I found all this stuff out, and Jim had some travel anyway, so. If it was just one of us gone, we probably would figure out a way to make it happen. But when you got both Jim and I gone, what the hell is even a Bald Move podcast, you know?
Yeah. Bringing two guest hosts.
Like you do. Hey, I mean, if we got away with it, I hate to tell you, it'd be hard to get us back. So If we could just put some cardboard cutouts out here and be done with it, that'd be tempting. But yeah, I just want to just reiterate again, we will not be having an instant take this week. We will have an instant take for the finale. And I've heard through the grapevine that these last two episodes are what you'd call bangers.
They kind of have really... to be, because if they're not, the story won't be told.
True.
You know?
But I mean, I think you'd wrap up the mystery in a satisfying way, but like I've heard them been described as like they kind of like bring the whole season together and are pretty bravura.
Okay.
Yeah, they're the type of episode you want to stand up and clap at the end. So I'm excited for that. I'm pretty excited to see how it all comes together.
Yeah, me too. All right, where do you want to start?
We've been leading with the mystery, but since the mystery kind of took a back seat, I thought we would kind of follow along with the True Detectives and kind of back our way into it. And let's start with Evangeline, because the big news here is the stuff with her sister. Is this the most depressing piece of Christmas content that you've consumed? Is this going to be a Jones family Christmas staple? You just can't wait to rewatch this, you know, maybe on Christmas Eve.
Yeah, maybe a whole Christmas season. I mean, why not? No, this is incredibly depressing. I mean, it's hard for me to think of a Christmas themed anything where somebody's sister takes their own life.
Yeah, I was say, Paul Giamatti's All Is Bright is pretty bleak in pieces, but in that your sister drowns herself because of a family curse, bleak. But that makes it worse, right? That like you've got, you know, this is the time, you know, it's a time of darkness, but you got the artificial light so that you kind of perk things up and you're supposed to be spending time with family. And I mean, I think that really hammers the isolation home. The fact that like, you know, culturally, this is supposed to be a time to come together with your family and love and understanding, empathy. And for these ladies, it's not coming.
For nobody. I mean, the thing that they're doing between sort of the culture of the indigenous peoples and the culture that I guess the latecomers to Alaska are bringing is really evident in those scenes, because you've got a whole bunch of people here who are not involved in that culture and they are experiencing extreme loneliness. And then you've got this kind of beautiful scene making bread or whatever they're making, biscuits in the kitchen with these three Native women. So
yeah,
They're definitely like reinforcing that theme, the connection to that spirituality, connection to each other, as opposed to the loneliness and isolation you feel when you don't think there's God, you don't have anybody else in your life. Yeah, it's pretty depressing.
Yeah. And it made me think of, because there's this on the official podcast, they had a Native gentleman that was talking about the legends and the religion of the Inupiaq or Inupiaq, I think is how it seems like the natives are pronouncing it. And he points out that, like, you know, that these beliefs are like embedded in the people's DNA, and it's kind of like been tried to beat out of them by the Europeans coming to, you know, spread Christianity and whatnot. And it's like, I, you know, obviously I don't know about the whole DNA of it. But I do, you know, it's like as I've learned more about religion across the globe, it seems like it's there to kind of like help people. And like it's like very particular to a place. You know, you might if you live down in the mountains, you might worship mountains. And if you live in a cold environment, you might have a different relationship than you do in a hot environment. And it seems like, you know, Christianity is something that spawns from the Middle East. It's like just doesn't fit in places that are like cold and dark for like half the year. Like the mythology has nothing to say about like what if the world is swallowed in darkness for 6 months out of the year. It's not suited for its task. I thought that I felt like they were kind of getting at that in this episode. But Julie, yeah, she's having you know, Navarre's got a lot. She's clearly agitated by the idea that Connolly might come and like take this whole thing away from them. And by the way, the women are behaving in this episode, I could totally see the larger jurisdiction, more experienced male cop coming in and be like, this is insane, taking you guys off the case. I'm exerting my jurisdiction. But also that Julia's just becoming to a head. And I was a little surprised that, you know, Liz shows up to kind of like rescue her at the beginning of the episode. And before the episode even has half its runtime half expanded, she's going to find a way to kill herself. It's like, you know, not even the lighthouse could save her at this point.
Yeah. And that's, you know, she's kind of the counterpoint to all of this, the stuff that I just talked about with the show depicting, you know, the indigenous people's culture as something that is, you know, communal and reinforcing. She's experiencing a very different kind of thing. And I don't know why that is. I don't know if they're trying to say, yes, this person is just mentally ill, or that it runs in their family and they all are, or if they're trying to do something to show kind of both sides of that. Like it's a blessing and a curse.
I thought it's interesting because the official podcast, it seems like and who knows, because again, showrunners are storytellers, and they get paid to do it, which is another way of saying they're professional liars. So she could be saying stuff in these interviews that are deliberately misleading. But one thing I thought was interesting is she called back to what Rose said about you mustn't confuse the supernatural and the afterlife for mental illness. And Issa Lopez called that back to specifically talk about Julia. And it feels to me like she is putting her thumb on the scale of rationality and be like, you know, she thinks she's seeing this. She thinks she's experiencing. But she didn't use that language when it comes to Navarro. So is it possible that like, yeah, Julia is mentally ill, but Navarro's got the gift like Rose does. But I don't know.
And she doesn't use that language with Rose either, right? I mean,
right.
So, yeah, I do feel like they're trying to say something where this is something to be respected and feared. Because the thing that rings in my head when I look at this stuff is what Rose says about the three types of spirits, the ones that want to tell you something, the ones that want to see you again, and the ones that want to take you. I forget exactly what they are, but it feels like there are different experiences for different people in regard to this spirituality stuff. And I don't know if that's her saying, yes, there are literally three, we've cataloged them and we know this, and or if she's saying like people have a different relationship with the spirituality of this place and this culture, and it can be healthy or unhealthy just depending on your viewpoint.
I was about to say something similar, that like, you know, from a therapeutic standpoint, like a therapist or a psychologist would say the difference between like a quirk or just the myriad of things that makes you and different and distinct from the other people, and like a pathology is whether it's interfering in your normal relationships and your ability to live as a human being. Sure. So like Rose gets like all these, you know, she's like the spooky spiritual lady, but it doesn't seem like she's particularly crippled by it. You know, she has a pretty high regard, able to make friendships and da da da. Whereas Julie, it seems like it's causing her to harm herself and eventually take her own life. But I don't know how to square that with the three types of ghosts, because if I was sitting there with Rose, like, how does Rose experience a ghost of trying to take her?
Yeah.
Because that just seems like that's
there
pathologic.
And mugs it until it gives
she's
up.
Like, she's like, get the fuck. Yeah. She like bang pots and like drive it off like a raccoon in your trash, or like, because yeah, that would be a healthy way to deal with it. But like, if that's something that she's like, oh, it's like, oh, the knights were the ones that want to take me, come, they're hard and I drink. It's like, well, now we're back into like mental illness, or that being pathologic. So I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's interesting to hear how Issa Lopez is talking about it. I want to talk, and if you have some more things to say about that, I wanted to springboard into the lighthouse proper.
Okay. You're listening to The World We Deserve. We'll be right back.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter.
Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on the series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live. We're back with more of The World We Deserve.
Did the lighthouse fail to contain Julia and protect her, or did the lighthouse, is there something more sinister here? Because I was, I just recently got that rewatch of True Detective Season 1, and the closest analog to the scene of Navarro showing up and blowing this place up is Russ interviewing the head Tuttle, I forget his name, but the televangelist, you know? Mm-hmm. And the interview with him, you definitely get that, like, there is some incompetence here that's deliberate. Like, oh, they lost a whole bunch of records, or, the hurricanes, there were sketchy records. But you kind of got the feeling that, like, oh, there's something sinister here. I just got, like, maybe incompetence, maybe, like, hey, we're not, like, a state research facility. We're not an institution. We're like a kind of like a quasi-religious community help center. We don't have the ability to keep people against their will. I didn't get any like, oh, this guy, you know, of course, he's just the guy doing the front desk at the graveyard shift. But I didn't get any like, oh, there's something sinister here. It's more of like, well, yeah, your sister signed in on her own accord. She can sign out. I would say maybe should have done a better job of alerting her next of kin that you're releasing her. Maybe make sure she has someone to pick her up. But, like, I didn't see anything sinister there. Are you – what's the psychosphere telling you about the lighthouse?
I feel the same way about it as you do. I think she just kind of left of her own accord. And, I mean, if it's not a facility that is designed to contain people, it might be she just walked out the front door and nobody even really knew.
Like, that's, yeah.
She's not in a mental ward at a hospital. She's not, yeah. like, this is not a facility with cages, you know? She could have just walked right out. So I don't think there's any foul play here, I assume, but I'm open to being wrong about that as well if we learn some more next episode.
What do you think Evangeline kind of like regards Julia as she's being inducted, and she's kind of has this weird look on her face. She says, "You knew you were going to stay here, didn't you?" Hmm. Did she, is that mean like, you know, you're finally scared enough by your own behavior that you want to be protected? Like, what exactly? I watched that a couple of times. I don't quite understand what she was getting at.
Yeah, same here. I don't know what she means by that either.
It's more, my intuition says that it's like, this is something between the sisters of like, you know, when you walked out, started stripping naked and like expose yourself to freezing cold temperatures, it will kill you in minutes, that like you were going to end up here and you probably needed to be here. And it seems like she was sincere about that until the corpse showed up under her bed, which,
Yeah, she didn't. I don't think she had intentions to walk out into the water until she realized that no matter what she
even
does
here,
yeah, even here, it's going to follow
doing,
her.
I'm finally doing the thing my sister said I have to do, and it's worse than ever.
Mm-hmm. She didn't give it much time. I mean, maybe, you know, let the drugs kick in or something first, but yeah.
Yeah. And then we get the orange roll out from underneath the bed. We got some interesting feedback about the symbolism of oranges. I'll tease it in case people normally skip the feedback, but apparently there is some association with orange, especially in Canada and indigenous peoples. And, you know, there's this, they call it Orange Shirt Day, which is like a commemoration of the, what do you call those? The schools that they would take native kids to essentially not make them native anymore.
Oh.
I forget what they call that, like the forced schooling, or there's a particular term of art for taking these kids into a school and like beating Christ into them and cutting their hair and not wearing, letting them wear their native garb and divorcing them from their native practices. And it just, it's a form of cultural genocide. The people remain, but the things that made them distinct from the colonizing culture have been erased.
Yeah, there's a really good episode of Reservation Dogs that deals with one of those schools.
It's like boarding schools or something like that. That's the euphemism for it. But yeah, stay tuned to feedback for some really fascinating stuff about that. But otherwise, you've got also just, you know, the naked association with death that we've gotten in cinema. And also that necklace reappearing.
Yeah, that's interesting to me. I don't know exactly what they're doing with that, because Navarro throws that away like two episodes ago.
Yeah. And it could be a physical necklace that her mom dropped in her, what, patrol? No, it couldn't have been. There's no way her mom, or did Navarro have that around and she just dropped it in the patrol car? I don't know.
I assume, or I guess it could be just a vision. Like, she throws that cross out, but the cross isn't real.
Yeah.
Because nobody else is around when she does that, so
it could be her trying to reject the traditions that have been foisted on them, and, you know, showing her struggling to reconnect with her roots.
Well, and rejecting the affliction that both her sister and her mother had. I mean, she's the one trying to keep it together for everybody, right?
True. So Navarro is out with Pete. We'll get to this, the mission they're on later, but she gets a call from the Coast Guard with some bad news. And I thought, you know, again, with the theme of loneliness, she has a person here, fellow member of the force, or I guess IA force, would probably be a sympathy, you know, someone who would show a sympathetic ear, and she chooses to not tell him anything. You know, she got this devastating news and he's like, is everything okay? She's like, oh yeah, fine. Go home, be with your family. She's not fine.
That's it. I think it's that thing. Go home and be with your family. It's December 24th. It's Christmas Eve. Like, she tells him this, and how's he going to go home to his family and have a nice Christmas Eve?
But that's she's the kind of isolating. That's not Christmas behavior. That's not the spirit of Christmas, is to keep those things to yourself and suffer in silence. And
yeah, that's true.
Yeah. And she pays the price for it because she transmutes this fear. Well, she's sad. She's got two negative emotions, sadness and fear. And she does the prototypically masculine thing of converting that through emotional alchemy to anger. Mm-hmm. She knows what she can do with that. And first she goes and blows up the lighthouse people. And then she goes, she passes this this wife beater, the guy who beat the Blue King crab lady up, the one with the missing fingers. And she finds him with his boys on Christmas Eve, and she just lights into them. And unfortunately, like I said, even a well-trained boxer of approximately the same size as three other dudes is going to have a hard time winning a street fight in those conditions. And she doesn't do it either. She just gets the piss beat out of her.
Yeah. I feel like we got to talk about this in conjunction with the scene with Kavik.
So that's why I was going to see if you had any like standalone takes, but yeah, she, and it's funny. It's like, she doesn't go to Kavik for help. She breaks into his bar and starts like treating herself.
Mm-hmm.
He goes and, you know, meets her with a shotgun and finds out that she's been battered and starts immediately taking care of her.
Which she could have gone home. She could have gone home to treat herself. I think this is her reaching out. It's
yes.
She expresses her emotions in really strange ways. And I think like Kavik earlier when he was with his dogs and, you know, telling this metaphor about the dog who's got this soft interior. If you just get past the, you know, the biting and the yelping and barking and stuff. I really like this scene. I think this is one of the best blendings of physical and emotional pain I've seen in a long time. The way that, you know, she's trying to be tough. She's like, don't touch my finger. It hurts. And Kavik distracts her with this surprise. I assume she thinks that he's proposing. Right? Mm-hmm. Like, hey, let's get married, which is insane given what's happening right now. This is a terrible time to propose. But he's distracting her to set her finger back in place to heal her. And the way she reacts to that is so interesting to me, because she screams because of the physical pain when he pulls her finger. And then she keeps screaming. She keeps saying, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you. And I think part of that is not because the hand hurts. I think it's her heart hurts. Like, she kind of got caught up in that moment. Like, she says, no, don't, like, this is stupid. Don't do this when he's getting down on one knee. And I think some of this is like, she kind of wants that to happen. And when he pulls that away and it's revealed for just a trick, just a distraction, I think she's extra hurt by that. And, you know, not for nothing, she's also extremely hurting because of her sister at this moment. So, like,
and
all
also
of that,
the broken finger just got set. There's
exactly, yeah,
there's
the
like three levels of
the physical and emotional pain. It's, I think it's really well done.
I do too. And I think that's 100% correct analysis, that as much as she would be the first person to do her Navarro thing of like, fuck you, Kavik, we're not getting married. What the hell does that even mean? And you start to wonder, like, how much of her pushing him at arm's length is, like, an attempt to protect him? Because it's like, well, if I'm inevitably going to succumb to the call of the ice, why the hell would I take a nice guy like Kavik and wreck him like that, you know?
And when she's sitting there asking, like, why are you alone? And like, in life. I mean, she's asking that of him because she wants to know why she's alone.
It's funny you interpreted that as like when he said, I'm not alone. He's like, do you think he means I have you?
I mean, that's probably one person he has, but he seems like a guy who has friends.
That's what I'm saying.
He's
I think
a bartender
that,
for God's sake.
Yeah, well, yeah, but I got that too, that like I have a full life where I'm plugged into my community and I have friends that I ice fish with and I have my family who's going to Disney
My
World
dogs.
Because, you know, and I got, yeah, like, I don't think that Kavik feels like he's not wanting to be with Navarro because he's desperate or because, you know, he's afraid of being alone. He wants because he loves her.
Yeah.
Yeah. How do those cheek piercings work in a fight? I was curious because I'm like, Jesus Christ, does she square up and fight in a ring with those? And I found a lot of pictures of her and her fighting career, and it seems like she removes those. But yeah. Like, I can't even imagine. Like, I imagine there's some kind of stud or something. Does it get just like punched into your cheeks and your teeth? And
I would think so. Yeah.
Oh my God.
it's like installing brass knuckles for your enemy.
For the other guy. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, here, come punch these brass knuckles I put on my jaw.
Yeah, you don't have to brass knuck up. I've got them. I got them pre-embedded into my cheeks. And she lost a tooth. I did feel like they went either too far in her immediate I got the fuck beat out of me makeup, or they didn't go far enough in her next morning I got my face put together makeup. Because, man, she
went
was
to her
battered.
Yeah.
I guess so.
You know, put the pad on, put the ice on.
Yeah, yeah. Vaseline your face up, send her back out there.
Mm-hmm. No, I think you're right. It was a little too extreme on both ends. She was both too beat up and too healed at the same time.
Yeah. I'm just thinking about, like, you know, just fully processing the death of her sister, because, like, the things that her sister is saying, and I think she meant them, this is before she saw her dead mom in her room. But like, yeah, I'll see you tomorrow and I love you and we'll have Christmas together and like all these like, you know, promises, and the fact that she was out there on the ice when she took the phone call being like, oh, yeah, I love my room. It's peaceful, quiet. This is multiple layers of betrayal and sadness and loss. I do wonder, like, I wonder if next episode Connelly's going to put like try, because like you got to think those guys that she attacked are going to probably call and press charges. You know, Liz fucked up her car. I think that got damaged, like, and she's driving around drunk. Like, I could see Connelly coming in with a head of steam being like, and they're all excited, like they've got this major break, and he's like, yeah, well, yoink, I'm taking you guys off.
Mm-hmm.
Which is also a very True Detective season one thing. Like, that's, you know, sure. Russ got pulled off the case not for self-destructive behavior, but for essentially pulling on too many Tuttle threads. But it's a very True Detective thing for the cheat to be pulled off the case because you're getting too close.
Yeah.
So Navarro shows up after this to talk to Liz, and they both kind of comment on each other's beat up appearance, because we'll be talking about Liz here in a minute, and she's been abusing herself. She realizes that she's lost the spiral stone, which we'll be talking about here in a bit. And she finds the bear, you know, because Liz is like giving her this whole bunch of guff about the spirit stuff isn't real and God's not real and it's only things in front of her face. And she's like, well, if that's all that's true, why do you hold on to this? And Liz angrily throws that shit out into the street theatrically. She reveals that her sister killed herself and that she's got this creeping dread that it's something that, you know, it's a curse that her family's going through, and she, you know, she's the next door for the Grim Reaper to take a step on, or to step up to.
Yeah, and there's a, I thought, slightly awkward turn of the conversation to the Wheeler case. They're trying to give us more info on that, but this didn't feel like the right place to do that.
It did feel a little abrupt, because you just had Liz screaming that nothing outside of this world exists, and then you saw a ghost, and I know you saw a ghost. Tell me about your ghost.
It didn't feel right in this scene, but maybe it does. She's give trying us to a little more information.
Was she trying to make the, like, I don't think Liz was like, you actually saw a ghost. I think she's like, you claim to saw a ghost, and that means, you know, that this is like, you just need to, maybe unlike your sister where you fight it tooth and nail until the very end, it's too late, maybe you should go into the lighthouse before you start actively trying to go out into the ice.
Sure. Yeah.
But I agree. I thought it felt a little there. I think a lot of the criticism of this season has been unfair and simply would not be happening if this was called Night Country. You know, I was thinking, like, I wonder if people would, like, imagine if, like, Sharp Objects, the person came there and be, I want to do the Sharp Objects. Well, you know, it's been a while since we've done True Detective. How do you feel about True Detective Sharp Objects? Mm-hmm. Fucking great show. But just by hanging True Detective on it, it's going to invite comparisons to maybe better television, certainly different types of television. I don't think it's really suited I don't think it's done what HBO's want to do, although I guess people are talking about it and more people are watching it. But
I think that's a preamble to say it's not perfect either.
It's not perfect, and there's a couple things I know. Like, I don't buy the Coast Guard finds her sister's body in the fucking Arctic Ocean on Christmas Eve an hour after she goes out onto the ice, essentially. Because it's the same fucking day.
Yeah.
That seemed like a crazy shortcut. I feel like there's a lot of ways you could have arrived at that, but like that was a pretty big, that's a pretty big reach, pretty big ask.
Yep, I'm with you.
So yeah, that's one of the first few honest criticisms that I felt like I've landed on the show. Do you want to rewind the tape a little bit and go down the Liz Danvers path, or do you have some more stuff you want to talk about Evangeline?
I mean, where she ends up this episode, I don't know if she is an active part of this investigation anymore, or if she is going to be completely sidelined by whatever injuries, self-inflicted or ghost-inflicted, she has at the end of this episode. That's
sometimes
my biggest question.
That happens, too. Like, in season two, wasn't... what was her...
Rachel McAdams.
Rachel McAdams, but is Antigone or something. I forget what her name was. Annie. Yeah. It was Annie. I thought, didn't she like get kidnapped essentially in the like the last episode or episode and a half? And it was,
I think so.
So it's like it's in the show's DNA for one of the true detectives to be sidelined. It happened to kind of Russ in a very small extent where he got, you know, stabbed and was incapacitated by the Yellow King before Marty came in there. And I guess Russ ends up saving himself kind of sort of with Marty's help, but it can happen. I think that Connelly's going to roll in there and try to take it all. I think that hit Liz and Navarro are going to have to work the rest of the case off the books.
Okay.
And maybe they'll have a leg up with like the native population that they're, you know, that's kind of thus far somewhat untapped resource on the show. It seems like her and like Liz has an antagonistic relationship with that, but like maybe her and Navarro will solve it with the help of the native population, and Connelly's going to do more of just like retreat back to Anchorage. I don't know.
I guess I just want to know what her mental state is. Is her head still in the investigation, or is her head in the spirit world? You know,
I said in the description that she was catatonic. I don't know if that's true, because she did respond to Liz.
She looks over at her.
It's just, she's had a fucking experience. I want to know, like, I want to hear, God damn, I'm so pissed we don't have an instant take this week. I want to hear what she says. Like,
yeah, why are your ears bleeding? What happened?
Is she catatonic? Is she going to have to go to the hospital for a bit? Yeah, what was your subjective experience of this, you know, whatever popped your ears and whatnot? I don't know.
I saw a boombox. Right. Maybe she turned that up too loud.
True, she had like Doc Brown's Back to the Future mega speaker experience. Let's move to Liz Danvers. What do you make of this noise machine is so fucking prominent. I got to think that they're doing something with it. Like, if is the implication of Liz would shut this damn noise machine off that maybe the dead would start talking to her? Like the reason that her son is running to Navarro and being like, tell mommy something, because he tries to tell her, and every time he does, she just turns the white noise machine up.
Yeah, so I was listening to the official cast, and they were talking about the polar bear and how that is basically, you know, the spirit world come knocking on Liz's door, but she doesn't believe in it. She rejects it. And yeah, I think the white noise machine is much like that. It's a representation of her blocking that out.
It seems like she's just completely haunted by this Annie situation. I'm not exactly. And I guess you're supposed to make the connection between Annie and her daughter and her worrying about something happened to her daughter, especially since she seems to be walking the path of Annie and getting involved in mind protesting. And, you know, we see what happened the last time that happened. I think all that stuff is tracking, but she's just extremely haunted by her inability to solve these cases.
And I think it comes to a head here with her finding Julia walking down the street half naked and putting the coat on her and saying, I'm going to keep you safe. I'm going to protect you. And then her killing herself at the end, being unable to protect her. I think there have to be some emotional ramifications next episode. And you can see it kind of on her face when Evangeline tells her. There's a big mix of emotions there, right? One, oops, I just said the dead are gone and they're nothing but meat and they need to be recycled and turned into fertilizer. And now she tells me her sister killed herself. Whoops, big foot in the mouth there. And then there's also that realization that, oh, I told her I was going to protect her. And I was so focused on this other thing that I wasn't there to do that. And I'm doing the same thing with my daughter. And like, there's so many layers to that reveal there that I think are just really well done.
Yeah, and if I wasn't drinking, maybe I would have caught into some of the signs, or I would have been, because she's very, it's like, you should take care of your sister and all, but like, maybe she should have backed off and spent some time with her family, spent some time, make sure that Navarro was okay. Yeah, definitely some guilt there. And I also really like the scene of her checking on her daughter and kind of brushing the hair out of her face. It shows that as much as her daughter thinks this is something that she feels forced to do, that she does have some genuinely motherly feelings towards her. And it's probably where, all, like you said, all the, she's taking that fear and transmuting it to anger at her daughter's tribal tattoos, at her daughter's protesting and being socially conscious, you know, even sleeping with other children, I guess, is something that could get a native kid in trouble.
That's the thing, kids just, you know, we talked about this with the video that Leah made in the first episode. The kids just don't understand some of the consequences that might arise from, you know, pretty radical actions, honestly.
Yeah. Why would they? Like, the idea that they die is like such a foreign
and they don't even, they don't have the experience to know things can go wrong.
Yeah. And they think that they're, you know, all their stuff has worked out because in all their short life, it all has. So.
And I say that to say, if Liz just sat down with her and said, look, I'm sorry I'm being a huge asshole here. I'm doing it to try and protect you because things can go badly when you think they can't. She just wouldn't get it. You know, it wouldn't register as true to her. It would be something that she would probably still resent. So
there's a scene with Connolly, who's coming to personally oversee a routine body transport, which she questions him on, and I got the implication that he's worried the case will be, you know, handled correctly, but he's kind of hoping that he can get some, Santa Claus needs some lovin's, what I'm saying. You know, and he's hoping that she'll be his Miss Claus. That's what I got.
Yeah, I mean, he's obviously very lonely up here on Christmas Eve, sitting in his hotel room, whitening his teeth and watching Elf.
Yeah.
So I definitely think, you know, if he's got to be here, he might as well get at least a little bit of attention from someone else, let's say.
Did you clock the maneuver he did with her water bottle?
I love that note. I think it's perfect.
Because I missed that the first time watching, or I didn't get the, but like, I got some thoughts about it. What do you think that they're, what are they getting at there with him sniffing that?
This is part of the subtle storytelling that I was talking about at the very beginning. He is sniffing this bottle. So what happens here, in case you missed it, is he picks up Liz's bottle off her desk, sniffs it, and then pours it into the plant to water it. He's checking to make sure that that is water. And not, let's say, Jack Daniels or Absolut Vodka, right?
Yes.
He, and this combined with the stuff he says about her being a mess earlier in her career, actually, even before the Jake and Holden thing happened, she was a mess. It tells me that she has had and probably still has a drinking problem. And then she says to Navarro later, look, I barely drink, you know? And I think that's something she does to keep herself in check, because she knows she can go off the deep end with that stuff.
Yeah,
so him sniffing,
I wonder,
it is just a brilliant, quick little way to tell us, oh yeah, he knows her history with this and it's not good.
Absolutely. That's exactly what I got out of it too. That, you know, and it's like, did she have a pretty bad drinking problem that she dried up for when the drunk driving incident happened? Or did she plunge into alcoholism after drunk driving and then Her daughter Leah's leg loss prompted her to, I guess it was, those were all the same thing too. But in any case, like so they have in AA a concept of a dry drunk. Have you heard that?
Huh.
Where it's like a person has abstained from drinking, but they haven't done any of the internal work to like not be an alcoholic. They're just like white knuckling sobriety. It's not an easy thing. It's like they're, I wonder if they're trying to show that she, because of the trauma of getting, you know, her loved ones killed through drunk driver, she's like dried up, but like the things that made her an alcoholic are still there. You know, she hasn't solved any of the internal void that's causing all these negative things that she has to self-medicate for. She's throwing herself into the work as a form of self-medication, as a form of distraction. It's really, like you said, I love it. I thought that was such a cool detail to throw in there.
Let me ask you this. What do you think is the timeline and the reasoning and like everything behind this? Because they make it clear that it didn't start, her drinking didn't start with Jake and Holden's death. She was a mess before that. And
yeah,
I look back at that dancing scene now where they say, oh yeah, she smoked weed. I wonder if, I don't have a good way to reconcile those two things, because she looks very happy, but she could also be drunk and high and abusing substances in that scene. And we're just seeing the part where everything is fine and okay with that because they're dancing in the living room, having a good time. And then you fast forward and she perhaps gets her husband and son killed.
Uh-huh. And also, I can't remember if Liz herself said or someone said it about them, that they, even Jake and her, had their, as happy as we saw them in that moment, they had their ups and downs.
Right.
It wasn't like a smooth, completely trouble-free relationship. So.
Mm-hmm. And the assessment of him, of Jake, seems to be, I guess, rosier than the assessment I've seen of Liz so far. I don't know if her demeanor changed after, I mean, obviously it changed after Jake and Holden died, but I wonder if, like, he was cool with that stuff, and, you know, he'd smoke weed and have a good time, but she, like, took it too far or something. She would abuse it, whereas he was just using it.
I also appreciate the way, because one of the questions I had in my mind is like, if when Connolly takes this over, is Liz going to try to pull a Hank and keep some of the case files back? Apparently, she shared everything with him. He even knows about the Annie video.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, she told him about her extracurricular forensic adventures. She told him about the video. I think they're trying to tell us that she's not trying to be territorial about this case thus far.
Yeah.
We also learned another detail when she's talking to Navarro about, you know, that Julie's praying a lot. We know that Navarro's praying a lot, that when she lost her mom at the tender age of 7, her dad encouraged his family to pray. And she said she prayed so hard that her knees turned black. And this is one of the, like, core of her atheism. Like, well, and I got nothing but black knees out of it. So then, you know, I kind of learned to go about the other way. Did you think anything is interesting about the symbolism of black knees?
No. Did you?
Just that, like, all the men who were flash frozen, their extremities were black. I associate black with, like, gangrene, dead tissue. You know, obviously, this is for very different reasons. This is like a black and blue bruising, but I thought there's some interesting parallels there and just the visuals of it. Right about here, Katie, who is owns the mine, as near as I can tell it, calls in the middle of the night, says there's a problem at the mine office. She goes down there, and Leah has vandalized the corporate headquarters of the silver mine with murderers and a skull at the end to punctuate it. And Liz essentially calls upon Katie's Christian decency and the spirit of the season to get her daughter home, which doesn't earn her any brownie points in her daughter's book because she moves out.
Yeah, no. I mean, the first thing she does is say, I ought to kill you, you know? This is...
Why do you always take their side?
I have a lot of complicated feelings about this scene. Not in its quality, just in the events of it. Like, I don't know if Kate feels like now she has something on Liz. Like, Liz owes her one.
Seems like it.
Yeah, there's a look on her face that says, ha, okay, I'm gonna let you off the hook, but I gotcha.
Or maybe she doesn't like the fact of being able to have her in her debt in some way.
Yeah, because I get the impression she also fucked her husband or something.
Oh, yeah, clearly.
Good Lord. And then I'm also conflicted on, you know, Leah's reaction to Liz's reaction, because, mm-hmm. you know, this is, like I said earlier, a pretty radical action to take. I get that your cause is just. I don't know. I'm conflicted on it.
I saw a lot of people, you know, even in our audience talking about, like, how could Lee expect her mom, the chief of police, to be okay with this? A lot of people had some takes on, is it Katie? Kayla is Pete's wife. Like, Pete's wife's being a giant bitch. Like, yeah, it's Christmas Eve, but this is like a sextuple homicide. And, you know, it's very little. But it's like, to me, this is telling a story of, it's not about this event. Like, if, you know, Liz has gotten a phone call about the girlfriend and the amateur child pornography and have been a little bit cooler about it and not gone right to be like, you're 17 and she's 15 and you should be smarter than this. And it's about the tattoos and you got to scrub that shit off your chin. It's about the, like, you're going to the mining protests, you know, and it's everything. Like, you always take their side. She's not just talking about the mine. She's like, every single time someone has lodged a complaint, even if it's relatively normal, healthy, like, I think it's a high risk behavior. Teenagers share nudes with themselves, but guess the fuck what? They're going to do it, you know?
Sure.
And as a parent, part of it is, like, you know, dealing with the, like, yeah, you got to guide them in the smarter decisions. But also, if I had a cell phone when I was 16 and I had a hot girl or boy I see in, I'd probably want to do that too. This is like, Leah just feels like at no time her mom has her back, when really her mom is just so fucking afraid of Leah making a mistake, so wind her up dead, that's all she can see.
And the tragedy of it is she's pushing her that direction by reacting the way she is, you know?
Yeah. And that's baseline mom stuff. Now she's also chief of police and she's the enforcer of the law. And the mine is, like, not the law, but it might as well be. I really like it. I think they're doing a really good job of showing how, like, fucked up these dynamics are and what impossible positions are. But
yeah,
I just want to push back a little bit of people saying, like, oh, Leah this or oh, Kayla that. Watch out for that polar bear. We'll be right back. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. Time to continue our investigation back to the world we deserve.
Right. Here's the real false note to me in this scene. Mm-hmm. Outside this office building, there are a couple of Teslas parked out there. Maybe they're a Model Y.
How much range do you get at negative 40 with a Tesla?
They got like 40 miles of range. Congratulations. Uh-huh. They have to tow a generator just to keep their battery charged. B, these are not equipped to deal with this amount of snow and ice. Like, everybody here should be driving trucks. Four-wheel drive,
cyber
large...
trucks.
Sure. Yeah.
I bet the salt on the roads would treat those stainless steel panels pretty good.
Oh yeah. Well, they have magnesium sacrificial, I don't know, bumpers.
They got zincs. They got zincs installed. Sacrificial anodes. Nice.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, yeah, nice. That's actually not a bad idea, honestly.
Yeah, the anodes.
No,
I just thought it was crazy to see two Teslas out there. I'm like, what good are those up here?
Liz tries to beg and cajole Leah to stay, spend Christmas with her. You know, she's been, again, this is like, she's been trying to do the good old-fashioned family Christmas, but they're not having a good old-fashioned family Christmas. And, you know, I kind of think Leah made the right choice when she goes and she's with her laundromat grandma and she's with her tribal sister, and they're having a great time. There's smiles and there's a genuine warmth. If she had stayed there with Liz, it would have been a shit show. It'd have been a shit show of sullenness, and Liz would have just gotten a tip and abandoned her in Christmas and Eve anyway. And
I love ahead. This. This is another really, I think, subtle and great scene. So what is your take on the turkey? Because I've seen a lot of people being like,
"Oh, we're taking turkey now. We're gonna take and talk turkey." Okay,
we're gonna talk turkey. I've seen a lot of people saying she doesn't have time to cook that turkey. A turkey takes, you know, a raw turkey like that, 4 hours in the oven minimum. She's already missed her window. And what the fuck is she talking about when she says you're going to miss the turkey? I think that's exactly the point.
Yes.
Is that Liz has been so distracted by this case that it's now, what, 6 p.m.? I don't know what time it is.
Who the fuck? It could be 3 p.m. for, yeah. But yeah, vandalism at night, it's late.
But she's going over to somebody else's house for dinner. So she's already missed the window on cooking this turkey.
Right.
Because she's so distracted by this case. They're telling us that she, like her saying you're going to miss the turkey, that's her fooling herself. Like she was never going to make this stupid
turkey.
This
house is not smelling of turkey. It's not like, you know, like look at all the work I've, it's, she's, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's what's going on in this scene. I think it's really good.
Intentions.
And when she throws it away, it's partially because she's pissed at Leah, but it's also because she's pissed at herself.
Yeah.
Like, oh, here's a stupid turkey that I never even cooked, and I'm trying to get my daughter to stay here for what? There's nothing here for her.
Yeah. I think you're absolutely right that the gap between her intentions with her family and her reality. And when I would say family, it's just her daughter. Like, she intends to give her this warm Christmas as a child, the stability. But she's not. And like, you know, the open question is if it hadn't been for these bodies dropped on her, would she's done a better job? It doesn't seem like it.
She'd have found some other thing to. Not when she says, oh, we're actually going to do the turkey this year. Right.
Yeah.
You get the impression this is not the first time the turkey hasn't happened.
Right. What is the commonality between Hank and Connolly watching Elf?
I don't know.
Is that just what's on? Or, like, I was trying to think, like, what is the...
Yeah, that is interesting. I mean, they have streaming services. in Alaska.
I mean, that's a hell of a show to watch on Christmas Eve. For sure. No problems there. It's just I thought it was interesting that they're both watching it. And it seemed like they're showing this scene of, like, Buddy falling in love, you know, with the what is her name? The Manic Pixie Dream Girl.
Zooey Deschanel.
Yes, Zooey Deschanel. And they're trying to, like, kind of amp up the loneliness of Hank. Like, oh, look at this guy falling in love with this gal, and my gal stood me up. I don't know.
Mm.
I don't know. But he's watching Elf, and Liz stops by, bleaching his teeth and watching Elf like you do. And Liz stops by to initiate sex with him, but he is worried. And they kind of, like, you know, he's asking some questions and she's picking up on it. And she accuses him of sending her to Ennis because she was scared that she was going to take his job. And he freely admits that you were the better cop than me, but you're shit with people. And I had to, and then you were being a mess, and I had to transfer you to where you couldn't hurt yourself or the department. I'm willing to bet it's a little bit 50-50 there, but, like, clearly she has some problems.
Yeah. I've just realized what Christopher Eccleston is doing with his accent.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. It's like a Boston Northeast accent. Right?
I think he watched a bunch of The Dangerous Catch, and he's going for a Pitch Perfect Stig.
Okay. Captain it could Stig. Be that.
Is this Captain Stig? Is that, or is that the test driver on the one car
on
show
Gear?
You like? Yeah.
I think it's both. I think Stig is the guy's first name. Yeah. And it's also, the driver. But that's very confusing to me. So he's got a Boston accent. Didn't Navarro say that her mother moved them to Boston?
True. Yeah.
And then came back to Alaska. Why is he from perhaps Boston? How did he get up here in Alaska?
I don't know.
Why is he here?
Is Alaska like in, is Boston like an Alaskan mine, like tropical Alaska?
Yeah, like a
town,
farm team for
work, where, you know, saw Alaskans. like it's like the most blue collar of the kind of like New England towns. Is that just reputation? They're like, New York, don't get me wrong, lots of blue collar, lots of tough, but like you also got Manhattan, you know, Philly's
Philly, Pittsburgh,
there's a lot. Yeah, I'm probably pissing a lot of people off. There's a lot of solid blue collar credentials, but not coastal towns. So, like, wonder if that's like, it's like, oh, this is just kind of like tropical Alaska, or like not as isolated. This is crowded Alaska. And it's like, well, if you're wanting to start over from the like Alaska's where everybody in America goes to start over. Well, if you want to start over in Alaska, where the hell do you go? Some fishing town. I don't know. Maybe.
I don't know. I just thought it was interesting that there's a, at least I think that's the accent he's doing. I don't know. It could just be that he's not doing a very good accent.
So Liz is pissed and she says, get drunk and do some hard driving. It's a lot of the hard driving, angry therapy in this episode. And she almost hits a polar bear this polar bear is like me trying to I just bought some food and it's packed in like a hard plastic clamshell. And it's like, ugh, it's not worth the effort to try to open this thing right now. It's kind of what I got from this polar bear. Yeah, there's too much glass and metal separating us, lady.
Yeah.
What do you think's going on with that?
I'm trying to remember exactly what they said in the official podcast, but this is essentially the spirit world knocking on her door, is what they were saying. Which I don't know how I feel about that. I guess I want something of more consequence than just a metaphor. If you're going to introduce something that is physically really there, I kind of want it to be physically really there in the story too. So I don't know if I'm totally sold on this polar bear stuff.
I think the polar bear is real, but
it
also
is.
Could be like,
but in
okay.
the story, it doesn't matter. All it is some totem that says, hey, the spirit world is right outside your door, Liz. If the polar bear like mauls somebody or becomes a clue in the case, then we can talk. But right now it's just there as a thematic element.
Well, you know, they say the murderer is always the person you medium suspect. Like, is that the polar bear? We medium suspect the polar bear.
Absolutely could be. Yeah.
So it's Christmas, and I like the scene of there's people ice skating in a pond, and Danvers has passed out, and she's remembering her child. She has a vision of what I would call a whalebone-based shrine that appears to be part of a larger graveyard. It really reminds me of this Native American graveyard I saw in the Beaver Island Archipelago on Garden Island. There's like a Native American graveyard that has all these just rows and rows and rows of spirit houses. You know, some of them simple, some of them more elaborate, but there's these kind of like Lincoln log structures contained designed to contain the person's soul, and you can leave them offerings and whatnot. But like, yeah, there's this like very distinctly non-Christian, although Christian in like a syncretic way. Like it's like you could see that the whale bones crossed over like a small literal cross, like a Jesus cross. What did you make of this imagery?
Nothing, unfortunately. I hadn't thought
of that.
You
can hear talking, the twist and shout, her humming, singing twist and shout, yeah. It's tied to Holden somehow. There's maybe Holden's trying to say something, because this happens right off the heel of the polar bear.
Yeah, could be.
And then yeah, there's this leads us to, you know, we already talked about Liz. I guess we'll get to the mystery of Otis Heiss and all that stuff. We might be able to transition to the mystery at this point. Before we do, I guess there's one little thing that I didn't know where to put exactly, and it's Navarro's meeting with Rose.
Okay.
What was the point of this? I loved it. It's great. I loved seeing Rose is living her best Christmas life. She's all dolled up. She's cooking. I think I understand that Navarro she's expecting company. Like, she thought Navarro was coming by, and she decided to go all out. You know, we found out that she is a professor from a very important school that wrote very important papers, that she just at some point realized, oh my God, all I am doing is contributing noise that doesn't matter to the world. And she wanted to move someplace quieter. And she found it ironic that Innes is quiet except for the dead. But what are we, I speculated that there's maybe something to climate change. She might've been a change research specialist or something. That was her area of expertise, but there's nothing in the episode to really substantiate that. Was it just a little character moment, like a little piece, little bit of peace for Navarro before they throw her off the deep end? Is it like, you know, Innes is quiet except for the dead?
I wonder if it's showing somebody who's okay with being alone. Yeah. Rose doesn't seem to have the same problems with loneliness that other people do. She's kind of happy in her loneliness.
She's constantly visited, you know?
It could be, yeah, that she's not actually alone. She has these spirits that are with her.
And they're more comforting than not, usually, it seems like.
It could be. It's just interesting, you know, that she's making... Because I don't think she knew Navarro was coming by. I think she's making this this dinner just to make it, yeah.
Okay.
This is for herself. This is... You know, maybe it's for the sake of her memories and the people that she's lost, or maybe it's just because she likes to bake and this is an occasion where it seems worth it. So, yeah, I thought it was saying somebody who is kind of okay in that loneliness, but who knows?
Gotcha. Okay. Well, let's move on to the mystery, which kind of got a little bit sidelined. There's one, like the big red letter event is Pete's research into any injuries consistent with the Slal Station incident has yielded fruit. And the personage of Otis Heiss, who back in the mid-90s suffered burns on both corneas, ruptured eardrums, and self-inflicted back. I guess it was in the late 90s, in 98. He's a German national with no work history, no current addresses, no known family, no known trace of any financial activity, a long history of criminal conduct, including disorderly conduct, possession of drugs. He's been in and out of rehab. He got picked up for causing a disturbance by a trooper 2 months ago. But unfortunately, there's no one left to look for him. So she bullies Pete into staying to doing an APB so they can look for both Clark and this Otis guy.
Yeah. I'm super curious how this connects to Oliver Tagok. And the thing that stuck out to me is the ID stuff, right? The name and the, like, we don't have any records of this guy. Oliver didn't have any records. And yet he was working at the Tsalal Research Station.
Yeah.
Something about that says they're connected, but I don't know how yet.
Yeah, I don't know either. I wonder if he's going to be the equipment manager before Tagok.
Maybe.
Because it seemed like no one knew that Tagok worked there too until someone started looking at things. So he's a big mystery. We'll be talking more about him. The other thing about this scene is them doing the mutual fuck yous reminded me of her interactions with Connolly. Mm-hmm. And just in the back, because, you know, they put in this whole kind of idea that maybe Liz is trying to sleep with Pete, or like maybe not trying to consciously, but subconsciously that's her goal with every human interaction, is to try to fuck him. I just thought that's very similar behavior she's showing with Connell. Now, they could be saying that she's just a misanthrope and she has this kind of like shitty behavior with everybody, but like the way those exchanges was almost exactly the same between her once and former lover and this guy, I thought, I don't know, I cocked a eyebrow medium high. One eyebrow, just one, medium high.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. She does the same exchange of fuck yous with Evangeline in this episode too. So,
well, you know, running. People are hot on the Evangeline and Liz theory too. So, they also, her and Liz, or speaking of Navarro, her and Navarro are talking about the presence of the ice caves and how there's a lack of ice caves in the area, which they think implies that the body was moved a considerable distance, which might imply that there was a message being sent, which I think is something that Liz has been resistant to or not wanting to pull too hard on.
Mm-hmm.
So they then go, they need to find someone that's got some expertise in ice caves. So surprise, surprise, they show up to the geology teacher's front door on Christmas Eve, which did not impress the man's wife very much.
Mm-hmm.
But he takes a look at the video. Very interesting. He says that he thinks these are prehistoric whale bones we're seeing in the ice.
Yeah, just immediately identifies them. Very confident. About that too.
Yeah, whale bones, probably prehistoric. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then he corrects the lady's misunderstanding that there are actually ice caves. They're just unmarked and extremely dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
That you would need maps to find them and an expert to guide you through, or it'd be suicide to investigate it. And he finds out that the name of the man who mapped these dangerous tunnels out once before, one Otis Heiss.
Yeah.
I have one burning question after seeing the scene.
Mm-hmm.
Why the fuck would you mount a lamp 1 foot over your head? So every time you get up, you have to either keep it in your mind to not thump it, or you're going to thump it. Like, you're setting yourself up, man. There's no cool or slick way from standing up from your seat that's not going to thump your noggin.
Nope. I agree. It's a terrible setup.
Anyway, later on, Liz is noticing a similarity between the video that the hot scientist filmed of making a sandwich and the last desperate moments of Annie K, which is she thinks that there is a similar power cut MO. I don't know. This felt very disconnected. I'm not like I thought this was a reach that she's making, and I'm curious if it's ever actually going to track back to You know, it's like, it's just like, oh, well, Tagok had a generator and he's kind of an asshole about the investigation, so let's go invade his house. Or like, is there going to be any other tie-ins besides cut power? Did the polar bear cut the power?
It's also not enough deduction. It's very obvious to me that a power outage would not stop a phone from recording a video. And so,
yes, and it didn't stop
video ends. Yeah, because
Annie,
right.
Like after power cuts, and she screams for quite a bit, and you know something's happening to her, and this was after the power was cut. So why did the recording stop at Slal Station and not?
Yeah.
Yeah,
she doesn't ask that question. She's asking the
She's
wrong.
She's not asking the right questions, yeah. Jim. Damn it. All right. So, she bullies Pete and Navarra into going to check it out because she's too drunk to do it. She's too drunk to be back up to Navarra, who could. And they're complaining about Danvers and how drunk she is, but also Navarro opines that she's probably onto something. And they arrive at the Nomad camp, and I couldn't help but notice all the very interesting bone sculptures that very much reminded me of season one True Detective. And he doesn't answer, so they let themselves in, and the cabin is just froze, completely abandoned. Pete says it feels a lot like what?
Salal, I think.
It didn't to me, though.
I don't know what else it would feel like, though.
Yeah. Like, Salal had power, which is interesting. If the power is cut, someone restored the power.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it wasn't, like, frozen inside and all that. Yeah, I wasn't sure exactly what about this reminded you of the Salal station? Someone leaving half-eaten food?
Is it maybe... Yeah, what would that remind him of? I don't think he was on the Force six years ago when Annie was killed.
No way. This kid, he'd have been like 18. Like, I think, what do you think this kid, because, so she's trying to get through nursing school. I think they're in late 20s. I was thinking even early 20s.
Yeah, it's possible. Like, either way, I really don't think he would have been there. I don't know.
So they find a spiral. I also noticed that he left his boots behind. That's an odd thing to leave behind in a big trek. They're right there by his shoes and his gun. But they did find on the floor a big cardboard sheet of paper that has a large spiral, and at the center of that spiral is a small stone spiral.
I think they're going to find his body next episode. Like, did he walk out?
That's what
ice.
I was thinking. That's what I would surmise when I saw the boots. I'm like, oh, he walked out on the ice again. But I don't, you know, who I don't know. Or maybe he's going to join the heist Clark, you know, former equipment engineer club that they got going on in the ice caves, which is, I think, what they're talking about with the. But we'll get to that in a minute. So as they're investigating, they hear a commotion outside, and they go out, and the men of the Nomad camp have got their dogs and their guns out, and they're not threatening the officers, but they're making them feel like they need to be moving on, which they do. And apparently he left the day after he came, and there was a marked increase in hostility when they started asking about the spiral. Do you think these men know about the spiral, or are they just being protective of their own?
They probably know something. I mean, that's the thing. If you want to know about the spiral, you can go ask Rose. And Evangeline knows this.
It is a little bothering that Rose seemed to know a lot more about. And maybe we're supposed to understand that Evangeline follow up on all those questions, and we're just not privy to it. But like, yeah,
that's
like
crazy.
She's like, oh, it's old. It's older than Innes, maybe. All right. No questions. No follow up. Hey, good for Christmas dinner, right? All right. I'll see you then. Like,
you're making
no
macarons, right? Awesome. Yeah. See you then.
Yeah.
No, it's crazy. And especially, you know, when you get this thing, like, Pete's not going to go follow up on it. I don't know. I mean, he wants to get home for Christmas. But yeah, that could be a pretty big hole in the plot here. Just go ask Rose.
Yeah. So Navarro and Liz are driving around when Pete calls and says the local fishermen have spotted some strange activity near the dredges that the man in a pink parka has been sighted. The pink parka that used to belong to Annie now belongs to Clark. So they're like, ah, damn, we've got our man. They go out to investigate. There's talk about these dredges. We talked about this on the instant take. Did you do any looking into these dredges?
The gold dredges? No.
Yeah. So these gold dredges are essentially giant industrialized versions of panning for gold. They have these buckets that scoop in the stream beds. They dump it into this massive cylindrical screen that like sifts anything that's bigger than like a quarter inch. Goes out the back, all the rocks and larger sediment. The smaller stuff is then finely sieved where, you know, it goes through. But it's essentially a minor panning for gold. Have you ever seen like the old 49ers, you know, panning for gold? It's essentially that at an industrial scale with these huge machines.
What if you find a big old nugget? What if you find a gold nugget? You're just going to kick it out the back with the rest of the rocks?
Apparently so. Apparently so. I mean, wow. But the thing is, like, so like these gold, so like the whole idea of my panning for gold in these streams is that, oh God, this is one of those things where I understand enough to kind of understand, but I realize I don't
watch
understand
Gold
explain
Rush.
It.
Like Alaska Gold Rush. I've seen enough of
honestly,
Alaska
yeah,
Gold Rush
like,
to know.
Honestly, a third of the Wikipedia article on these gold dredges is about their revival on this show. Because nice. Apparently what happened is like they would run these machines, these big, large machines for they'd build them and run them for 30, 40 years. And whenever the gold output dropped below the cost of maintaining a machine, they just leave them there. And there's like all these abandoned things. Sometimes they've been made into natural parks or like points of interest. But there's like dotted all over the American West and Alaska are these just abandoned dredges just like this one. So, but yeah, they chase him out there. They go in inside the machinery. There's all these weird murals. There's like what I can only refer to as a spider monkey. There's a boombox with a burning barrel. There's another one of those like menacing bloody spirals. And sure enough, a man running in a pink parka. Liz gives chase. She finds out that it's not Clark. It's actually Otis Heiss. And apparently he's been living out there. She asks where Raymond Clark is. He knows that name. It says he's gone. He went back down to hide. He's hiding in the night country. We're all in the night country now. Let's stop there for a minute. What do you think the night country is?
I've been racking my brain trying to figure out an actual definition for this.
I think the key, and again, I could be full of shit, but I think the key to understanding this is him saying he went back down to hide. I think the night country is the ice caves.
It's certainly possible.
And I'm also going to state an additional internet points on the reason that they're called this by the weird Blackwater drinking cult or whatever. These people have gone crazy on the ice is because probably even at high summer, those caves like at best are lit like this pale blue, like this twilight color. And it's kind of like they're the same all year round, or maybe just your underground is dark. But I think night country is these unlisted, unlicensed, dangerous caves that these crazy people hide out on.
Which can kind of reflect, you know, the Carcosa stuff from season one, right?
Absolutely.
It's sort of a literal place, but it's also sort of a vibe, right?
Yeah. Like it was a real place, but they've done some work to the place, you know?
Right. So yeah, I get behind that. And it's the big hanging thread in this episode. You know, all of the investigation that they do is around this Otis Heiss guy and figuring out who might know about the ice caves. We haven't got to the ice caves yet. That's where the real action is.
Yep. We've got 2 hours left to explore them. Meanwhile, so Liz is running after. As she runs after, Navarro hears this ghostly whisper calling to her. And she follows it. She sees her dead sister floating far below her in the bowels of the machinery of this dredge. She follows and sees bare footprints that go deeper and deeper into the building until they eventually just stop. And she investigates there, sees a lit Christmas tree powered by car batteries, and she is confronted with the vision of her dead frozen sister. And then then Liz gets done with Otis. They don't make this clear. I'm assuming she handcuffs him and secures him and then goes to try to find her partner.
Yeah, we'll see his fate, because that is really the only thing that makes any sense.
Yeah. But she finds her sitting kind of cross-legged in front of this Christmas tree, barely responsive, with bleeding trickles of blood coming from her ear, from her ears. Apparently suffered a burst eardrum.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else on the mystery track? Like I said, that's not a lot of information. No. We found out, you know, whale bones, prehistoric whale bones, Otis Heiss, and
now they have a guy who might lead them to the caves, the ice caves.
Yeah, so. Has at least familiarity, the expert. He is the expert. He's the guy who mapped them. He's seen better days, but...
Yeah. I do wonder why... Well, maybe it's because he experienced whatever the Night Country insanity is in a place that wasn't frozen solid, but I do wonder why he doesn't have the same grievous injuries that the scientists do, because the scientists, I mean, even Lund didn't survive, right?
It killed him. Maybe because she wasn't awoke yet, whatever she and awake means.
And I'm curious to see Clark, what his status is when we finally see him. Don't be afraid of the dark. We'll be right back. She's awake, and we're back. Here's more of The World We Deserve.
All right, well, let's move on to Pete and Hank. Hank is waiting for his fiance at the local airport with an Alaskan rabbit, and he's desperate. It seems like everybody's left, and he sees this very attractive woman approach the stairway, and she just retracts it, and they take off. That's the thing, is like, this is where it's like, I think he's this type of idiot where he's engaged in his relationship with sight unseen. Even though he's sending her pictures, though.
Right. That's what it is.
It's a one-sided catfishing.
That was actually her, but she saw how old he was. This guy's not 25. This guy's 50.
Yeah. She looks as like, this dude's like 20 years older than I thought he was. Hey, would you go ahead and push up the stairs? I'm going back to Russia. I'm just going to go across the strait.
She bought a round trip ticket just in case with his money.
So Hank goes back to the station, starts drinking spiked coffee, AKA the classic Four Loko. And he confesses to his son Pete that his fiance wasn't on the plane, but he makes some emergency. Something happened with her mom, and Pete's like, "Oh, Dad, you haven't sent her money, have you?" And then he immediately changes to like, "You know what? I'm free for Christmas Eve. How about I hang with the family?"
Mm-hmm.
What'd you make of Pete's?
I don't trust this chipper, Hank. Hank knows. Hank feels the betrayal. Hank feels the shame, the embarrassment. Hank is going to be a problem next episode for somebody.
It could be, especially if Liz goes at him, and Liz absolutely will go at him. I think that he's got at least one half of his brain still in denial. That like maybe something happened at customs. Maybe something happened with her mother at the last minute. Maybe she probably would at least called or texted. But I don't know. I think that maybe that's where he started. And by the end of the episode, as he watches Elf and sees his giant bottle of champagne in the bed, he's like, but yeah.
It's interesting to me how he reacts here, because If he does realize that he's been fooled, then all he's doing here is prolonging or delaying the inevitable, right? Because there's going to be a point where he has to admit that if this woman's never going to show up. That's the thing. And so there will become a point where he has to admit to not just himself, but to everyone, that he was fooled. Yeah. And he's just like this chipper act. Oh, I'm sure there's a reason we'll do it. He's just trying to deal with this emotional bomb later, I guess.
Yeah. So what do you think about Pete? What is his excitement level at his old man joining him for Christmas Eve?
it seems semi-genuine, although he does at the end say, well, I need to, you know, call up my wife and
talk
to her.
That was my read, that Pete's kind of happy that he's going to stop by, but then thinks, oh, but I'm kind of already in Dutch with my wife or working late on Christmas Eve. What about,
Yeah, she's making a meal with Laundromat Grandma, and is there going to be enough for an extra person? All that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And that's the next scene, as you see Kayla and Leah and Grandma having a great time cooking, and then you see Peter calling, and her face kind of falls, and she excuses herself. So obviously, it's kind of ruined the good time that they were having. We talked about this in the instant take, but like Hank watching Elf and seeing the giant bottle of champagne, which is, I think, a nice bottle. It's like a 50-60. It's not like Asti Spumante or Brut or, you know, whatever the $5 bottles. Like, they used to be the $2 bottles, but now $5 because of inflation. It's actually champagne. It's bubbly.
Nice.
His camo bed sheets with the fucking rose petals on it and another stuffed animal. It made me feel bad for Hank. I didn't think that could happen. Mm-hmm. And you know, if he came home and like trashed a place, I'd been fuck you, get what you deserve. But he's genuinely kind of devastated, and it felt Christmas Eve, man. It's Christmas Eve.
Yeah, nobody deserves that on Christmas Eve.
Not even fucking Scrooge, right?
Yeah.
So then Pete walks home, and this is brutal too, after his adventures, and he sees the glow of the Christmas tree, you know, and all the Christmas presents underneath it. And he goes to get in bed with his wife, but he apologizes, and she snaps, because he doesn't give a genuine apology. It's more of like, you're being a bitch apology. And she just says, let me sleep. And he drops out, why don't you say it, that I ruined your life and you didn't want to have the baby?
Wow.
And the overhead shot of the demilitarized zone that is their bed is another, like, Hank and Pete. Ugh. I would not trade Christmases with them.
No.
It feels a little bit like he kind of Jerry from Rick and Morty. He kind of Jerry'd her Beth. Like, he locked her down with a child that she might have wanted, like, to get, might have wanted to have an abortion and maybe gone to medical school and maybe gotten away from Ennis, and he trapped her with a whole bunch of promises about support and help, and here she's raising the kid alone on Christmas. It's like, yeah, this isn't just this case, is what I'm begging for people to understand. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a long process. It's got them to this level of yeah. If this is the first time, I would be like, yeah, you know, Kayla, Jesus Christ, it's not every Christmas that you catch a octuple homicide investigation.
Yeah.
That opens up a 6-year-old investigation into a native woman that's murdered and all that. And you only, but like, it's clearly been a process that Liz has been doing and that he's been ignoring, and there's promises made and not promises kept. And that's my read of it anyway.
Yeah. And it's tough too, because like Liz in this episode is more nakedly manipulative, I think, of Pete than she has been in the past. But before, it's always been orders, like, you know, go do this thing, and Pete's been like, okay, fine.
Yeah,
means I'm gonna miss another night with my wife and I'm supposed to watch the kid or whatever. Here she makes him choose between his father and his wife, in this case her, in fact. And then when he picks the same thing that he's always picked, she gives him the pat on the head, right? Like, and she says, she has to like beg him, I couldn't do this without you. And then she says, that's my boy, when he agrees.
Yeah.
There's something grosser about this that's going on here. Because, I mean, saying that stuff, like, that's my boy in particular.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't your kid.
Mm-mm.
This is Hank's kid. You know that Hank has a problem with the way you've been moving in on this relationship, whether it's sexual or not, it doesn't matter. I think it's a little gross, that line from her, that's my boy.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. Do we have anything else we need to discuss about the episode proper, or should we start huffing some Psychosphere?
Yeah, let's sniff it. I'm ready.
All right. We got a lot of email. TrueDetective@baldmove.com is how you send it in to us. Also, if you want to know what we're doing next, because we're gearing up to do, I believe, Shogun and The Walking Dead, The Ones Who Live, the Rick and Michonne series. We got Pulp and Prestige covered. If you want to keep up with what we're doing in terms of movies and whatnot, we have a social media. We have many social medias. They're all at Bald Move. Pick which one you want to follow and follow it. And then finally, if you'd like to support us, they get ad-free feeds. If you'd like to get access to the fabulous instant takes that we won't be doing this weekend. We will not be doing it this weekend. But for the finale, definitely want to get in on that. We could use your support. Support.baldmove.com. You give us money, we'll give you more podcasts and ad-free feeds. Win-win. All right, up first, the TrueDetective@baldmove.com hotline. Harris. My only hesitation at this point is halfway point in the show. The killer is the guy you most medium suspect, not the person you most suspect. Hank is definitely the guy I most suspect. First, okay. He's a creep. Again, that's almost an exoneration at this point, but he's such a creep. The big clue of episode 3 was the blue hair dye. It was actually the blue paint from the room Hank is painting for his Russian bride. Plus this episode, Peter brings the skates to the rink that has blue paint on it. It seems to exactly match the paint in the picture. This paint comes from Hank. Plus, if you go back to the episode 1, that same paint is all over Hank's clothes and hands. We know Hank is connecting to the Mine Women. We know there's a motive for them to have killed Annie in their protests. Hank also got to Slough Station first and is evasive when Danvers asks why he got there first. The only exoneration for Hank is the halfway point the guy all signs are pointing out can't actually be the killer. I will want to point out that almost all of your evidence is neatly explained by the guy painting his wife or his fiance's room blue. He got blue paint on his hands and blue paint on the skates. I mean, if you want to say he got blue paint on Annie's hair 6 years ago, okay. But Navarro doesn't seem to think so. Navarro seems to think that the hair dye lady did it.
Well, blue paint on the photo. How recent is that blue paint? Is that blue paint from back in the day when she was having her hair dyed? I mean, wouldn't the photo be there, I guess? But or is it from Hank rifling through these files to make sure there's nothing in there that connects him or something before he hands them over to Liz, and that's why he's dragging his feet?
It looked like ink, not paint to me. It looked like, you know, like dye, you know, like the kind of dye you would get if you showed a picture to your hairdresser and her hands were covered in dye, you know. Sure. But I understand. I want to bring it back to someone that I keep coming back to. You know, you watch True Detective, you meet the killer riding a lawnmower in the third episode. And he will not come back into the story until the final one. Who do you think the person most resembling this is? Kavik. Incidental contact? Kavik. Yeah. Kavik? You think Kavik has been this one guy who had this one scene and we never saw him again?
Yeah.
But you're on the cat because we do have some we got some Kavik feedback. Kavik is medium suspected.
It would be real heartbreaking if that were the case.
Rose,
she's like the most incidental character I can think of, but she's been in it a few times.
I'm gonna go with the woman who matches the handprint on the men's boots that were missing fingers, that mousy Claire character in the background, that was kind of the focus of an investigation, but then this other thing happened, and I think it goes like she's somehow connected. I don't know that she's a bad person, but she is somehow connected to this Annie situation, to the disappearance of the men. That's the person that I am medium suspecting right now.
All right. Let's go to Sean from Cincinnati. Local boy. Says, totally agree on the obviousness of a common Arctic star-shaped tool, but what if it's a common, quotes, tool, but not really obvious to most folks. I took to looking into it and found that there are various shapes and gauges of leather punch tools. And he includes a photo here of some star-shaped leather punches of various sizes. Says, wouldn't seem totally unusual for some leather craft to be present in Innis.
I keep coming back to, like, if this was a common thing in the trade, people would know about it. maybe there's this one person that does. But that's what I'm saying. Like, so, like, if it's someone from Ennis, I can't believe no one knows. Like, oh yeah, it's Bob. He does all the star shaped assless chaps down. You know, it's like he's famous for his star punched assless chaps, or he's famous for his moccasins that got the stars punched out of it. Like, somebody would know. It's too small of a town for someone to be using, you know, anything like that. But that, I will say that if I was to describe the wound one of these tools would make, it would be star-shaped. It looks like it's designed to punch out star-shaped things out of organic tissue. Because it is.
Yeah, exactly that. Mm-hmm.
Sarah P says, one thing I haven't heard speculated among much is the star-shaped weapon used on Annie K, and maybe that's because, as you'll see, it isn't much help narrowing down suspects. But for the sake of internet points, the star-shaped wounds could come from a Torx screwdriver bit or wrench. The larger ones can go up to T100 at 22 millimeters wide. And here's the kicker. They can be used on heavy machinery, vehicles, electronics, which doesn't eliminate anyone in this challenging environment. They ever get to this specific investigation, some star bits are hauled out as a security feature, which might narrow it down to Salal Station, but just could easily be tied to proprietary mining equipment. So, okay, but this next one, check this out. The alternative is a much wilder pull, in that some Mosasauruses were known to have star-shaped teeth. Perhaps you stumbled into it. Yep. I'll get there here in a minute.
Okay.
So, okay. No. All right. We'll do it. Mosasaurus are like a form of aquatic dinosaur. Like, I would call them the plesiosaurs, but they're short neck, and they could get massive, like 50 feet or longer.
I see where you're going with this. Yep.
Perhaps you stumbled into cross-platform promotion for the upcoming Netflix series around Jurassic Park called Chaos Theory. But maybe that got kicked off when the Salal scientist coring down the ice shelf from the Cretaceous period unwittingly woke a female Mosasaurus. She's awake, who then killed Annie K when she attempted to green piece the beast back into the sea. I don't know how serious she was, because I'm like, star-shaped teeth, get the fuck out of here. But I did a little search, and apparently, recently, Moroccan and North African species of ancient Mosasaur has been discovered as star-shaped teeth. They've been described as looking like a Phillips head screwdriver with like an extra fin on it. These teeth, and they can be like an inch or two long with these 50-foot Mosasaurs. I could see a weapon with that could punch. And could you misinterpret a mo? Because I saw some skeletons of them, and I looked at side by side with the whale, and you could easily mistake a Mosasaurus skeleton for a whale skeleton, I would think.
Yeah, that was the interesting part of this. I think both of these theories become more plausible this episode with what we found out about Otis Heiss and him being what the former or no I'm sorry was it Takak who was the former like engineer at the station he would probably have a lot of Torx head screwdriver stuff sitting around and you start stabbing somebody, there might be some Torx head shaped wounds. So that's a little tidbit. And then on the other side here with the teeth, I think saying, hey, those are whale bones. I'm super curious because this guy seemed very confident. And
yeah. Especially with the ancient, because like this is a culture. This is one of the few cultures on Earth that can hunt whales without any kind of like Alaskan Native Americans are allowed to hunt a certain amount. And I don't even think a certain amount. They're allowed to hunt whales to subsist on. So like this is a culture we saw with their burial sites, that they're like the whale. This, you know, with the seal and the polar bear and the walrus and everything out, they this is a big part of their culture. So like for him to be like, oh, those are whale bones, probably prehistoric. That prehistoric has got to mean something.
Yeah. And she's down in the ice caves, you could see some thaw happening down there to make the caves. And there happens to be these Mosasaurus teeth sitting around, and they're used as the murder weapon for whatever reason.
I know there's there's some Native American, especially like in Central America, I'm thinking like the Incans and Aztec would make these war clubs that were these kind of like flat paddles, and they embed sharp flint and stone to make like these cutting surfaces, but they'd also embed animal teeth.
Yeah.
So it's like, Now, this is Central America is pretty far fucking away from, you know, the Inuit and Inupiat cultures of Alaska and Canada.
Mm-hmm.
But could you make a primitive dagger out of one of these star shaped teeth? Like, I don't,
sure. Yeah. I don't know how they'll discover that. The scientists will call them back up and say, actually, I was wrong about the whale right thing. It's a mosasaur.
Right as they're going to the ice cave, they'll get a call as the cell phone receptions. I was wrong, Liz. It's not a whale bone. It's a
mosasaur
tooth.
She's awake.
You gotta
She's
get
awake.
Out. You gotta get out. She's yeah, yeah. I can see it.
Yeah. All right. Let's move on to Gnarls. He says, I was thinking about the interview with Finn Bennett, where he claims to pay attention to the oranges. Because of this, more discussion of the incident on the tundra with Navarro and her throwing of the orange is warranted. Earlier in the season, in this very episode, the issue of Navarro's Inupiaq name is brought into question. This issue of what it means is to be a part of indigenous culture in Innis affects other characters as well, Leah and Annie Kay. So anyways, back to the oranges, it is well documented that scurvy has been endemic for outsiders living in Arctic regions due to short supply of vitamin C dietarily. Indigenous communities avoid scurvy by outcome of their diet. Fresh meat and fish, plants and berries. This is the reason why Hank's hillbillies have a bunch of oranges. When Navarro tosses the orange into the tundra and the tundra returns the orange to her, I believe this is related to her relationship with her own culture. In many ways, Navarro is an outsider, despite also being a member of the community. Does the Tundra, Sedna, whoever is awake, know that she cannot remember her Inupiaq name? Could a reconnection to her culture be the key to solving the Annie Kay and Salal cases?
So I thought this email pairs well with another one sent by Jessica S. I just want to go ahead and reading. She says, I had an idea about the orange imagery because it can also symbolize forced assimilation. Orange Shirt Day is specific to Canada and honors Indigenous children sent to residential schools. As an aside, I looked into this on Wikipedia, and it explains that the National Day for Truth or Reconciliation, originally and still colloquially known as Orange Shirt Day, is a Canadian holiday to recognize the legacy of Canadian Indian residential school systems. The use of orange shirt as a symbol was inspired by the accounts of Phyllis Jack Webstad, whose personal clothing, including a brand new orange shirt, was taken from her during her first day of residential schooling and never returned. The orange shirt is thus used as a symbol of the forced assimilation of Indigenous children that the residential school system enforced. Back to Jessica's email. She says, I'd guess that oranges are very expensive to import thus far north and thus hard to come by. I'd then go as far as to say, make the assumption that oranges were not something native cultures even knew about in northern Alaska until the white people started colonizing. The frivolousness and ignorance of these white hunters is exemplified by their purchases of these oranges in a careless way which they're cared for them. Evangeline is literally throwing a symbol of forced assimilation away from her, and it comes rolling right back. I think we're on to something. I think that it still works in the Godfather sense, but like if you're Issa Lopez and you're researching, because you know this isn't her culture. You know, Issa Lopez is, you know, I think passionate about the Indigenous women thing, and she's curious about it, and she wants to tell a story, but she's not telling a story about her culture. I think if she's doing research and she sees about Orange Shirt Day, and she can take a Western motif of death and roll that into that, that's pretty fucking tasty.
Yeah, I think the other thing that this orange stuff is doing is it's saying, Evangeline is trying to reject that spiritual calling she's getting, but it's pointless. She can't reject it. It's just like her sister did, right? And it's the same. It's her polar bear. What the polar bear is to Liz, the orange is to seemingly both of the sisters.
I think it's interesting too, the whole like the scurvy aspect of like the, you know, because I hear that the natives in Alaska, I could be wrong, but this is what I've come to understood. Not only do they get most of their vitamin C through eating animals, but they like cook a lot of things that like we throw out, like the liver. The liver is very rich in vitamins and minerals, as something that they incorporate into their diet more so than like we consider it as like awful. You know, like that's like. That's the stuff of the animal you throw away, like the brains, the tongue, the organs. That's that organy meat that like only poor people eat, right? I think that's there's something to all that. And it's like the orange is a symbol of the outsider that she's trying to reject. It's also the symbol of forced colonization and assimilation. There's got to be something to some of these theories, I think.
Yeah. Makes some sense. All right. Cassie B writes in, I think that when Danvers is on her phone and she says she's on Tinder or doing fantasy football, I think she's actually the fake Russian bride and is effing with Hank. I don't think those details were called out to further define Danvers' personality.
I don't know how serious she is, but I kind of love that Liz that is the hilarious one catfishing Hank. You're going to keep my department's records, Dick? Well, I'm going to invent a Russian bride for you to fall on like a sword.
Yep. And then number two, Danvers has been pretending to hate Navarro to protect her from Hank. Hank knows what really went down with the Wheeler case and is holding that over Danvers' head, which is also why she can't properly discipline him. Danvers sent Navarro to the troopers so that Hank would not be able to mess with her and is pretending to hate her so that Hank doesn't go after Navarro to mess with Danvers. Navarro does not know that Hank knows and thinks Danvers actually hates her.
That's plausible that, like, she's shielding her from, you know, but I don't know, because the other thing I don't like about this is that Hank, I think, is the original police chief. And then Danvers got kicked out of there and kind of took over. So, like,
yeah,
you know, how would he not know that they developed a really I like it in theory. I just don't know if it's gonna work out in practice. Rachel from West Virginia says, I found myself enthralled this season of True Detective. I'm loving the mystery of the scientist and Annie Kay. I couldn't help but notice some similarities between the death of the scientist and an old Soviet cold case from the February of the 1959 that Dyatlov Pass incident. The particular cause involved 9 student trekkers from a polytechnical institute that went missing during a hike. They were later found outside their tent, some without any clothes on, and all with various injuries, including missing eyeballs, fractured skulls, and missing tongue. It's a mystery for years. Why did they run out of their tent without clothes or shoes in sub-zero temps? Many theories abounded, military involved, infrasound waves, animal attack, avalanche. At the time, it was concluded that a compelling natural force drove them outside their tent. Recent interest in the case led to new investigations. It's come to the conclusion that an avalanche caused them to run out of their tent and animals were the cause of the injuries to their bodies. I guess team rational for the win. Either way, it's an interesting subject if you wish to delve into it more. We talked about this in the preview podcast. Like, this is one of the main things that inspired this story. And I keep getting like 4 to 6 emails each week, so I wanted to talk about it again. I don't think there's anything more to it than, like, this is the real life inspiration for, you know, this event. I will say that, like, I didn't read the avalanche theory. The theory that I read is that, like, essentially a carbon dioxide poisoning from their poorly maintained cooking gear got them all, like, you know, asphyxiating themselves. And then that plus the cold caused paradoxical undressing. And then they died of exposure, and then animals preyed on their dead bodies. But regardless, you know, I don't think that, it's just my opinion that sifting through that case is not going to give us the real answer to the killers here. You know, these are just something that inspired her to write this story. You know, that's just my 2 cents on it. I could be wrong, but that's one of the reasons I have kind of been skipping these, because we already talked about it in a preview podcast, and there's been nothing that I've seen thus far that connects the two other than the obvious inspiration there. Your thoughts, Jim?
Ferris Bueller drove them all insane, so they ran out into the snow and died.
Boom. Solved.
All right, Derek from New Jersey. You may have touched already on this, but I keep going back to the opening quote in season 4, episode 1, being from Hildred Castain. She was an unreliable narrator, and therefore I believe the investigators are all unreliable as well, especially Navarro, due to the water/ancient bacteria theory. Thanks. Hope you boys are drinking Lone Stars and none of that fancy shit.
Yeah, I've gone full circle. In my early 30s, I was a big fan of the hops and the sours and the cloudies. And now that I'm an ancient 40-year-old, I've gone back to just, I like Pabst Blue Ribbon and Miller High Life, and that's it. I can't drink a 200 IBU beer anymore, man. It's just not happening.
I'm like Liz with beers. I rarely drink beer.
Yeah. I looked into, we talked about this before when the name got dropped, but like this Repair of Reputations is a short story published by Chambers, in his collection The King in Yellow that he wrote in 1895. It's an example of his horror fiction, and it's one of the ones that contains The King in Yellow, which is why we're all a Twitter about it. The story is set in New York City in the year 1920, 25 years after the story's publication. So it's a sci-fi novel of its day. It's told from the view of Hildred Castang, a man whose personality changes drastically following a head injury sustained by falling from his horse. He's subsequently committed to the asylum for the treatment of insanity by Dr. Archer. Due to his accident, Hildred is a prime example of an unreliable narrator. This is going to come back to just head trauma.
Yeah.
The concussions and the blows to the head, which Navarro, not for nothing, sustained even more severe ones to this episode.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm dead serious. I think that this is like almost a smoking gun. That this,
what about
this
her
is
sister?
The
did she get like
drunk driving car accident head okay. trauma? It all comes. It's all drunk driving and head trauma.
Yeah, I mean it's. I don't know. I guess if they examine her in the hospital next episode and say, oh, yeah, you have a massive concussion and you've probably had one for your entire life. I guess.
Blue Sleeve says, after the second episode, I rewatched all of season one because I felt like I was missing a lot of the connective tissue Easter eggs. After this past week, I find myself starting to get a lot of Lost vibes, beginning to feel like things will not really get answered and possibly not really connect, with the exception of name drops and the same spiral imagery. My hopes, which is not likely to come to fruition, is that this season ends with a solid through line that kicks open the doors to a larger Tuttle conspiracy. Because after all, Russ did mention not getting all the bad guys in the season one finale. Do you think that all this connective Easter egg tissue is going to be red herrings, or will we actually get a tight, thorough line connecting season one and four to each other? Maybe this could even lay the groundwork for an end cap season five, perhaps a team up. I think this pairs nicely with the next email from Alexander. Jim, would you like to read that?
Sure. Alexander says, thinking a lot about season one and how we know without a doubt that Night Country was written and then retrofitted. I think it's pretty clear these are just nods to season one. Maybe it's done to service theory craft, but I think Issa had Rose have a deceased lover. She just slapped coal on it. She probably had an arcane symbol, so she went with a spiral. There was likely going to be a crab factory, so why not Blue King Crab? Shady Shell Company behind stuff? Sure, Tuttle. Point being, it's not actually going to circle back, and I don't think trying to solve for that is worth the effort. It's a standalone story and a heck of a good one.
I think that's literally true. The only thing that makes me not suspect it is that it really does feel like a lot of the particulars of Liz and Evangeline are based on Marty and Russ. But okay. Even then, it's like supposedly Jodie Foster came in and reinvented the Liz character to be more closely, you know, something that she could portray. So it's like, I don't even fucking know. But it seems like this makes a lot of sense what Alexander's saying, but like there are so many clear parallels between Marty and Russ and Liz and Evangeline, even down to their police encounters and how they're going about business, that yeah, like it almost makes me think that maybe this interview is a psyop and this was more tightly planned on season one. But I literally like if I'm being team rational, I literally think what they're laying out here is the truth, that like there is going to be very cosmetic tie-ins to the season. But, you know.
Yeah, I'm starting to feel that for sure. I don't. Here's the other thing. I don't think it's a good idea to bust open a Tuttle door. I don't know. I'm not looking for that out of True Detective, I guess, to kick yeah. open the door and suddenly tie all these seasons together.
From Louisiana all the way up to Alaska, yeah.
Yeah, and then do another few seasons to capitalize on the groundwork they laid here. That's just not what I want from this inherent anthology show. The nods are okay. Here's what I think we're going to get, is we're going to get unsatisfying ending point for the spirit, the ghost stuff. They're not going to actually tell us whether these ghosts are real, whether these people are insane, whatever. What we are going to get is concrete answers for how these people were killed.
Okay.
The mystery has to be solved, because That's one thing they do in season one. They solve the mystery. Like, we know
this person
what
killed
the tunnels
these
were
people.
Up to.
Yep.
Yeah, we know how they were doing it, all of that stuff. We have to know how these people died. And if we don't know that by the end of the season, I think that's a failure of a murder mystery show.
I agree. I do get the sneaking suspicion that this is going to feel much like Enemy, Lies Beneath, what was it? What Lies Beneath, much like Issa Lopez's other work, Tigers Are Not Afraid. I think that, like, you could watch Tigers Not Afraid with a skeptical hat and be like, oh, these are children having some shared hallucination off of some trauma, and that this, what really happened was this or that. But I think Issa and the film itself has a point of view that no actually supernatural shit happened.
And I think that's true of this as well. Yeah.
I think that's what's going to go down. That, like, you could be like, oh, well, you know, she hit her head and she's running low on vitamin C and she huffed a little bit too much psychosphere. And she's losing. She's
paying $20 for Oreos has driven her mad. Yeah.
the Alaskan based inflation is just too much. But, like, uh-huh. I think that the show's POV is going to be something supernatural's happened.
I think that's what it's shaping up to be. But I also want concrete answers about how these people died.
I think we'll get that too. Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah. The next one, Mike from Brooklyn says, I want to talk a bit about a win for Team Irrational and a trope that truly grinds my gears. So far, I'm absolutely loving this season. The writing's been exceptional, acting incredible, but they're definitely putting their fingers on a scale for Team Irrational this week. Danvers acknowledged that Navarro saw a ghost or spirit. Danvers is now a trope called the Natheist, which is a really common trope in Christian media. To be a Natheist, a character must be loudly and aggressively and performatively professing their lack of faith, but actually deep down know that God exists and is just angry at God for taking away something from them, usually a loved one. As an atheist, I find this trope extremely condescending. I'm not an atheist because of something awful happened to me. In fact, I feel incredibly fortunate. I won't necessarily go as far as our friend Russ Cole, but we and the world are just an evolutionary phenomenon and not the result of anything magical. It's another clear signal that the show will be heading into the supernatural direction. While I object to this overused trope in general, it won't deter me from enjoying the otherwise fantastic season of television. Got a atheist with a bit of a chip on the old shoulder, it seems.
I'm with you. This absolutely feels condescending when they do this. As somebody who... I think comes by their atheism honestly, and it's weird because if you look at my past, you could say, well, this guy definitely has a chip on his shoulder. That's why he doesn't believe in God. The trouble with that is when I tell people I never believed in God. I was part of a cult that believed in a God so fervently that they eventually cast me out for not believing, and among other things, that for breaking their rules essentially. Mm-hmm. I never believed it. That's the thing. I just never felt like there was anything else there. So, yeah, when you say, oh, these atheists, you know, they protest too much, it's insulting. It's absolutely insulting.
However, I absolutely know of these Natheists. Like, these, they walk amongst us. Like, it is like,
I'm sure they exist,
you know, like people that are butthurt by their experience of religion and people who... are mad at God and like reject him because like I can't conceive of a heavenly father would actually behaving this way. That's different than someone who's just like, oh, I've looked at the evidence and it turns out this is all, you know, fairy tale type stuff. So it's like, I can't get too mad at it because I've known people that I, you know, just like we talk about dry drunks, I believe on the Instant Take, maybe we talked about this on this podcast. I think there's dry atheists or dry theists, which are white knuckling the absence of God and are terrified to die. And there's, so like,
I mean, the reason this is a trope is because that's the most dramatic place to take an atheist to, right? The point where that belief system is challenged. And it just so happens that everybody who writes about this eventually wants to say, oh yeah, the atheist is wrong, because a lot of people, because the vast majority of people in this world, in this country, absolutely are Christian,
and they argue,
have the viewpoint of God exists, and so when they're writing something about an atheist, they're writing from that viewpoint.
And you could argue from a storytelling perspective, a world with an active God is way cooler and more interesting.
You could argue it, sure.
Yeah,
potentially.
Yeah, for certain types of stories. So like I said, I don't begrudge it. Like And I don't even see it as kind of thing, because it's like, it just, I don't see myself in that intro. It's like, you know, like some people get like really fucking offended when women start talking about all men do this or that or the other. I never feel offended because like I fucking don't, you know.
Well, it's the frequency of it, right? Like far more times the atheist is written like this than just somebody who doesn't believe in God, and that's a thing. And it's not their defining characteristic, right? I mean, the way atheists are written about is much like the reasons people object to a lot of the writing around women in cinema too.
Right.
It's because it's an unfair categorization, and it keeps happening over and over and over again.
You know who's played a pretty well-written atheist? Jodie fucking Foster in the movie
Contact. Man. Yeah.
Want to see Scene? You want to see Scene? How about a movie written by an arch atheist
that holds
his book's ideals?
Anyway. How about a movie starring Jodie Foster on screen with Matthew McConaughey?
There's your connection. There's your connection. Young Russ Cole, before he joined the police force, he was a traveling scientist preacher man.
Yeah, pretty much. All right, let's go to the last email here. Yeah. Gabe says, I wanted to write to see if anyone else picked up on another recurring one-eyed face. We've seen polar bears, stuffed animals, and people with missing eyes. However, this one went unnoticed by myself until my wife pointed it out last week when we were watching. I know this sounds crazy, but if you squint your eyes while looking at the Alaska police patch on the shoulder of Danvers or her team, the patch vaguely resembles a face with a missing eye.
Is this another one that I put because I'm just getting an enormous volume of this from like week two, and I keep on like, your guys are crazy. I'm not seeing it. Two things. I got tired of like everyone writing it in, so I'm acknowledging it. And the other thing is I noticed for the first time that smiley face, it's the patch on the shoulder, it's got a winking eye that looks like it's missing an eye. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, at this point, it's missing eyes all the way down. So you guys might be fucking right. This Alaskan police patch might look kind of like a skull with a missing eye. Is what I was most commonly. It's like a death's head with one eye missing.
And
so
all these people's burned
it.
Out eyes are the left side, like Lund and Otis and the
except
the
for Holden who covers
sickle.
His right. That's the one exception. In this whole fucking deal is Holden covering.
But, and the woman at the wake or whatever it was for the baby, her right eye.
Oh,
was
on the wrong side too. Yeah. But there you go. So, there's your one-eyed theory rundown for the week. Mm-hmm. TrueDetective@baldmove.com is how you can tell us about the Yatlov Pass and the one-eyed patches and anything else you want to talk about. TrueDetective@baldmove.com. Follow us on all social medias @baldmove. And again, if you're looking for ad-free feeds and extra features like the Instant Take, Instant Talk podcast, which again, we're not doing this weekend, but we will be doing for the finale. You know you want in on that. You know we need your support. Support.baldmove.com to put a little something in the basket. That's it for this week. Can't wait to talk about this next penultimate episode on Tuesday, and it's regularly scheduled for the full podcast. Until then, I'm your host, Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.